Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. I'm Dr. Marty Gentius, and this week on Counselor Audio Source, Tom Newman, doctoral student at Kent State University, interviews Mary Beth Towle, an independently licensed clinical counselor and co-executive director of Summit Family Solutions. They will be discussing at-risk youth and home-based treatment.
Sitting with Mary Beth Towle, and I just want to say thanks for taking the time to sit down with me today.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
Great. I think the focus of what we wanted to discuss today was your clinical experience with at-risk adolescents and youths.
Excellent. So you probably want a little bit of background. Who is this person, huh?
Sure, absolutely.
Sitting across the table from you. I've actually, I feel pretty fortunate to be, have seen both sides. In dealing with at-risk adolescents, I think there's the residential side and then there's the home-based side. And of course, I'm sitting here advocating the home-based side, but I did have some experience coming out of my counseling program working in a residential treatment facility for adolescent males who had committed a felony-level crime and also had a severe mental illness. Obviously, it was a little longer term, and I didn't get to see much of the results afterwards. They left the facility, and I left them at that point once they removed. And then for the last 4 years, I have spent my time doing intensive home-based family therapy for adolescent youth.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you mean by intensive home-based therapy?
Sure. Intensive home-based, obviously, home-based means in the home, meaning that I go to the youth's home. It's all the therapy is done in the home with as many people and family members and supports as possible around. It's intensive in the fact that it can, although short term, 3 to 5 months, intensive in the fact that we can be there 24/7 in a crisis situation every day if need be to help support the family in managing the child in the home. And I guess when I also say home-based, I mean that my role was also part of the community. And I guess that builds into the systemic, the word systemic that I used. If the child is involved in any extracurriculars, if the child is involved in the court system, if the child's involved and having difficulties at school, if there's a church congregation that the family belongs to, it's involving myself in everything, but going to them. So it's more of an outreach thing. We go to wherever the problem is, wherever the needs are with the families, but the client never comes or the family never comes to an office per se. I always go to them.
Okay. So you've been in the classroom?
Yes.
Working with students and teachers?
Oh, yes. And there are times it's amazing where just sitting and observing and learning the interactions that go on, whether it's in the home or the school, how the teacher and the student get along, how the client and the peers get along, how the family members interact and communicate with each other. So immersing myself or yourselves in those, in the lives like that of these families and of these clients, you really get a very broad and vast range of experiences and perspectives. And I think it makes it much easier to see where the problems maybe have occurred and why these kids are at risk for removal.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about, you said that court would be involved as well.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of a role would you take in a court setting?
In a court setting, obviously advocating with the parent, for the parent, but also for the union of the family. A lot of times these children are at risk and this is their final chance, is this home-based therapy. And I think that when there is change, behaviors tend to get worse before they get better. And so often a lot of our this is your last chance type of kid does see the inside of the courtroom again, because as change occurs, they start acting out a little bit more.
Okay.
And so my role is to advocate for the family union to stick together and to highlight the successes that have gone on with the families and the improvements they have made, and help the families keep their family intact.
And my understanding, you know, this sounds like an awful lot of work. My understanding is that there's a team approach involved.
There is a team. It obviously, and it's funny that you should say that, because a lot of the families that we get involved with have every service provider under the sun in there with them. Okay. They have maybe a caseworker, maybe there is a case manager. The parents might have people involved for them, their own therapists, their own service providers, their own case managers. There might be individual therapists. You know, there's just usually a ton of people involved. And so although we use a team approach, I think the thing that actually works best is when the specific home-based team comes in, because everyone is on the same page. A key component in the team is a medically trained child psychiatrist, who also does home-based visits, which, as you know, is pretty rare to have doctor calls these days.
So she would come to the home with a therapist.
He or she would come to the home with a therapist, and spend a lot of time in the home and doing extensive interviewing and observing of the families to see if the child indeed has a medical or need for any type of psychotropic medication, if there's a real medical need for this child to be on medication, or is it just behaviors? And the beauty of it is having a person on your team that is trained in the same manner that we were, which is to keep the family at home, and that behaviors tend to be the first area of attack, that the psychiatrist would also feel like, yes, we need to get the behaviors under control first and then see, is there a medical necessity? So obviously there's supervision involved as well. There's a team of people. You know, I love to tell you, Tom, that I'm Superwoman and I can do 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to all my families, but I can't. So another part of the team is a bunch of trained therapists all in the same way who can rotate an on-call system as well.
Okay. So you are available to the family 24 hours a day, 7 days a week?
7 days a week.
What sorts of things do you tend to manage during those on-call periods?
Well, and it ranges. I would say that a lot of times there are maybe some runaway kids, maybe there's some suicidal threats, homicidal threats, maybe even some homicidal actions. You know, with adolescents, it runs the gamut. You have anything from the panicked phone call from the parent who says he never came home, you know, from curfew, to I just found an empty bottle of pills. So obviously you pick and choose. There are some things that you need to go out and support the family on and help with. There's been some domestic violence issues that have gone on, and obviously there's support. But for instance, if the kid has run away, you know, it might be something that you can manage, help them manage over the phone. I think that the balance of this job is not taking over the parent role, but rather helping the parent be the parent.
Okay. And that sounds like it would have a benefit in that after you're no longer actively working with the family.
Absolutely. It is. It's the how is this going to sustain? And if I do everything for you, which I think being in the helping profession, we kind of get caught up in here, let me do this for you, as opposed to let me support you in doing this on your own, so that there can be lasting change. I'm a formal support. I am short term. And if I were to get the kid to behave for me, then I'm really not doing the family a service or any of my clients a service.
That's an interesting way of looking at it. Now, I have to ask, you know, you're talking about 24/7 availability, the potential to see the family every day on a daily basis. A psychiatrist that comes to your house, how does a family afford services like this?
Ooh, good question. You know, it's interesting. Part of what we do is very outcome-based also, and I think that that's a key component in keeping track of the research and our successes. And it worked out that if you were to look at the statistics and look at the research, a lot of the counties, even in Ohio, have recognized that if you put the money into home-based services, it actually is a much lesser expense than if you were to put kids in residential treatment centers. So the beautiful thing is that a lot of times you have counties or agencies or state or grant funding that is willing to actually fund our services. And that's, I think, the ultimate goal, is seeing that by putting us in place, we're going to save the county money in the long run. And where I worked, that was the case, that it was fully funded and the services were free. Although I will say to those counties, you know, worldwide, nationwide, whatever, that Medicaid just did pass the home-based bill so that therapists and providers can bill through Medicaid now, which does open up, you know, a lot of windows for bringing these type of intensive services.
Additional funding.
Absolutely. But right now it's the research that shows that this is effective and this is working, and people are willing to fund this because it saves them in the long run.
I've had some experiences working with families, and I always am cautious going in when you're looking at parenting, because I think it, in a difficult sort of way, you're telling the parents of a child, you know, that that maybe you're not managing or coping as well as you could. And I think, how do maintain the delicate balance between maybe offering some additional tools and not really offending or putting off a client family?
I think it's a fine dance, and ultimately the approach going in and the mindset going in as the therapist is that you put the parent in the expert role, because it's true, the parent knows much more about the kid and their family than I do. Mm-hmm. So really looking at what the family's strengths are, looking at what they do well, what the family's good at, what the individuals are good at collectively, and using those tools, their own tools, to create successes. So although it can be a fine dance, I think if you go in and put the parent in the expert role and collaborate with them, I found it's been pretty successful in being able to then offer a suggestion here and there. And a lot of the times, Tom, when you're in the home like that, it's just role modeling. You know, you model for them how it needs to be done. I mean, something as simple as ignoring. We all know it sounds simple, and it's really not when you've got a kid, you know, standing over you with, you know, God only knows what, threatening your life. You know, ignoring those things is tough, but modeling that for the parents as well as maintaining, boosting them up and letting them know you're going to support them. I think that it's amazing what little difficulty you have engaging a parent if you truly give them credibility.
Okay. And, you know, how did you find these families, or how would they find a service like this?
There is a program that's another research-based program right now called a wraparound system program. It's the wraparound, where anybody can refer. A parent, a school, a friend can refer to one community agency that does a wraparound. And the wraparound consists of several members of the team. Somebody from the court, somebody from the Department of Job and Family Services, from MRDD, from all different agencies, from the advocacy programs, and along with the parent and the child, they hold a meeting and they determine which services that the community has best fits that family.
Okay.
So the referrals can come from anywhere at any time. And I'm sure in every community it's different. It might be a crisis center. It might be at a hospital, you know, wherever the headquarters are, but a team of people then do a long interview, and the wraparound coordinator actually follows the family to make sure that the services put in place are actually appropriate. Because in all cases, you know, intensive home-based isn't the right way to go.
Okay. Can you maybe draw me sort of a verbal picture of what a session would look like? Would you meet with the child for a while and then with the parents? Is there...
Oh, and here's where it gets sticky, and all my individual therapists are going to be angry with me here, Tom, when I say that. Although the client is the adolescent, very, very rarely, almost, I would be willing to say almost never, do I meet individually with the adolescent. And I call it family therapy because we do involve the child, but mainly it is with the parent, or the parent caregivers, whoever that may be. So a typical session would be, I would go to the home and the parent and the caregiver would be there. If the kid is home, that's great. I usually do like to be at home, at least when the child is home, so that I can kind of check out the communications and how the parents are managing and actually see in vivo what's going on. Mm-hmm. But it's mainly with the parents and working on, okay, what problems are you seeing here? We've got a behavior contract put in place. How's that working? How's that not working? Or what are the latest struggles? Or, you know, you kind of go where you have a plan, but you kind of go where the need is, because right now, if you don't address that need with the family, it's going to be harder for them to focus in on what's important to you if you don't tackle what's important to them.
Okay. So kind of family driven,
yes.
You know, goal wise, but still, I know you had said outcomes are measured, and I would assume that you would have to focus some time on meeting outcomes, if that's how your funding is based, in a manner of speaking. What might typical outcomes for a program like this look like?
Well, for this program specifically, I think the outcomes is you've got a kid here who's at risk being away. So we'd be looking, is the client free of the court system? Like, no, for about 10 weeks, 8 to 10 weeks, you don't want, towards the end of treatment, you don't want to see any more court involvement. So are they legal free? You want to know that the kid is in the home. I mean, that obviously a good outcome is that you've helped the family and they're still there.
So they're managing well to be able to keep them there, even though they were at risk of
absolutely
being pulled. Okay.
You want them either in a school or full-time job. Obviously, if you've got a kid who's dropped out, they're going to be more at risk. So, you know, we're going to measure those. And drug-free. So that's the other one. We want the kids. And sometimes we have kids who come in without using drugs, but other times, you know, you do have, when you have kids who are at risk, they usually have peers who tend to be at risk also. And as we know, that peers are the biggest influence on our adolescents these days. And so even if they don't use, they may be at risk for using. So being drug-free would be another one. And we do that through urine drug screens. We do equip the parents, and as therapists, we use urine drug screens to.
So you'll take them to the home and do a drug test?
Absolutely. And sometimes we'll even leave the drug and alcohol screens with the parents so that the kids know that mom and dad are on it, or caregiver is on it, foster mom, whoever it may be.
Okay. Well, I keep coming back to a statement you had made earlier when you were talking about ignoring as a parenting tool, about a child standing over you holding whatever. It sounds like there may at times be safety concerns.
Sure.
In the home. How would you go about managing something like that?
Well, I think with safety concerns, that my first step, and I think overall the training that we've received, is you need to make your house safe for the kids. And so we do what's called a safety checklist, and that even for kids who maybe might normally not be violent, again, as parents start changing their routine and start enforcing rules and consequences, kids' behavior escalates. They might, you know, a kid who's never been violent may, to up the ante a little to try to get mom and dad to break, might use violence. And so the first thing we do is do a safety checklist and get lock boxes and lock up all the sharps, anything, knives, scissors, razors, anything like that. All the medications needs to be locked. You do a full survey of the home. And so at least, you know, the kid doesn't have anything, you know, obviously they can pick up a chair, but at that point, telling the kid not, you know, to put that back or to stop isn't the right way to do it. And so if I'm in the home and the kid's threatening a parent, you know, I would casually say, oh, look, so-and-so, you know, Tom, I got something in my car. Why don't you come with me? And removing ourselves from that situation. A lot of times we'll have, when kids are raging, I'll take the session out, and my locked car is a great place for us to be. We might have a kid banging on the windows, but, you know, safety is always an issue. But I think if you take the preliminary precautions, initially, when the first time you step foot in that house, it's pretty minor after that.
And you said that the program that you've been involved with is short term. What's the I mean, how do you kind of set a timeline for when you'll be done with a family?
Oh, you know, Tom, I think the research and what we've the research has shown is that short term is more effective. And I think that is the longer that you're in the family, probably the longer you're doing a little enabling instead of setting them up. And I enjoy the short term because it keeps me on my toes. It means, okay, I need to get this group of skills across to this parent and this parent managing the situation without me in 3 to 5 months. And that is our length of time. I will say that when you have a team of specialists that actually do have a psychiatrist on hand, the length of stay does go up. If there are kids who have some mental illnesses, the length of time tends to go, 6 to 7 months.
Comorbid behavioral, maybe AOD, and mental health issues together.
It's going to be a little bit,
Okay.
longer, but 3 to 5 months. And what you typically see in the trend is that probably for about the first 3 months, it is pretty intensive. And you're working with the family to manage behaviors. And right at around 3 months, if you're doing your job and the parents kind of bought into what you're doing and able to execute when you're not there and feeling confident they can do this and using their extra, informal supports, around three to 4 months, the behavior drops off pretty much completely. And then we go into what we call monitoring mode so that the family knows, okay, I'm doing well. I don't need to see, she doesn't, Mary Beth doesn't need to come into my house 50 times a day anymore. Now it's just, once a week, twice a week, and then maybe once every other week. And we slowly phase out so that the parent, we can still problem solve, but that there are skills. And
And you're sort of maybe handing the reins
oh,
completely
fully.
back to them
Yes.
and reinforcing the successes that really they have put in place in the home just with your support.
100% them. I always say that, if it's successful, it's all they're doing. If it's a failure, it's mine. So.
And that's maybe more responsibility than some counselors would take on their onto their shoulders.
Well, and I
I
think you
think
have
when
to.
okay, and I think when we were talking earlier, you had mentioned something about the team having a treatment team sort of raising the bar.
Absolutely.
Can you tell me what your personal experience with that was like?
With the treatment team?
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because I think that probably the most skilled group of people I've ever worked with was in this job. I mean, there was not a person who would not cover something for you if you needed it. So it really is I think the how you compose a team and the people you put together have to mesh because you really are using each other to help out in all aspects. And the psychiatrist and the supervision was, fairly intense. We had standards that we had to meet and we had expectations on us. And so a lot of times the availability to go to your team members to problem solve, because there are times, Tom, that you sit there in your session and the parent throws something your way and you say, I have absolutely no clue what to tell you.
Sure.
And the beauty of having that team and what worked well for me was being able to say, you know what, I'll take this back to the team. I'll take this back because supervision could be daily if you needed it, going back to your team members. And I always found that the team members probably had more profound and wonderful examples and suggestions than even the supervisors, because we've all done our, when you're in the field and doing it every day, you get creative. And so having that team to bounce ideas off of and having the humility to say, gosh, I really don't know, but I'm going to find an answer for you and let me get back to you on that. And I will say that something that I didn't mention earlier is the psychiatrist is also available to the families 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So, being able to use her with anything, a client overdoses and being able to, call the poison control, but also call the psychiatrist and say, hey, this is what they took. And having the psychiatrist be able to say, okay, get them to Children's Hospital and I will call Children's Hospital and I will consult. I mean, it really, it's, I think it's imperative to have that teamwork.
Sounds like an awful lot of support built around the family and
Absolutely.
around the therapist themselves.
Well, and interestingly enough, the family has a lot of support, and yet the only person they see is the therapist and maybe the psychiatrist. And so gone are the case managers, gone are the other workers that were involved. And I do think that because this is a team effort, they do get even more support. than they would if they had 50 people involved.
And I, you know, I'm getting the sense that maybe the other providers that are involved, since you're there so frequently, are taking more of a back seat during that period.
We would ask them to do that, actually. And part of that is because what we do, and because we need outcomes, we need to know it's what we're doing that's working, you know, that we're giving the interventions and helping engage the family. And if you have multiple service providers involved, you don't know it works. Kind of like if you change more than one medication at a time, you don't know which one caused, you know, caused the problem or the success. And so we do part of the wraparound session that I was talking about earlier, when the group of people come together, they know that if home-based services kind of become the service of choice, everyone else does back out. And in my community that I work, that was well known, that if home-based got involved, then other service providers could kind of take a breath and, you know, we communicate with them and do monthly meetings. And obviously when other service providers, because there sometimes is a need and the parents have people involved with them, I think the one thing that we do is try to facilitate sessions where all the service providers are together so that the parent isn't getting mixed messages.
Okay. Interesting. You've talked a lot about addressing behaviors.
Yes.
What happens in the, you know, the high incidences of children with traumatic experiences or with maybe underlying a mental health diagnosis? How does a program like this manage those kinds of concerns?
I know the philosophy is, we can't get to the emotion until we get to the behavior. And safety, these kids are at risk. So we're talking kids who are removing them from the home. So if we're going to be, you know, talking about their emotions and evoking, you know, past trauma, we're going to have huge more behavior, you know, a lot more behavior problems, and the kids are going to be shipped away. So what we do is target the behaviors first. Let's get the behaviors under control so that we can deal with the trauma. There are some cases, and I've been a part of them. I've been fortunate to be a part where once the behaviors came under control, the parent regained the head of the household role, they were able to manage without further services. However, the kids who have had serious trauma, I think that my role towards closing is, if the behavior is under control, I'm going to refer you to a research-based program. And right now, I think cutting edge for kids with trauma is trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. And so I would help link them up with a specialist in that area. Obviously, the goal would be, if it's just a pure behavior problem, there would be no further involvement in any system. But there are those extenuating circumstances, and at that point, once we have the behaviors under control, then I think the child is going to be able to cope, the family is going to be able to deal with whatever trauma or major issue they've got underlying.
So the program sort of focuses on creating a safe, supportive environment in which those concerns can be addressed down the line.
Down the line.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. And the one thing that I don't think I mentioned is the support system. I know that a lot of times, and I'm going to be careful when I say this, but I will say many of my families coming in, their support system were all formal supports. It was, you know, the caseworker, it was the Department of Job and Family Service, it was the, you know, everybody that was in their home helping them every day. And a lot of these families didn't have outside informal supports. And when I mean informal supports, I mean friends, I mean extended family members, I mean a next door neighbor, you know, even anything extracurricular. A church I consider a semi-formal support. You know, there is obviously some leadership and guidance and something, you know, like that, and you know, teachers, but really helping along the way to get the parents to reach out to, or the caregivers to reach out to other people and gain a support system and a support network, you know, around them, so that when we're gone, their first call isn't to the therapist, the crisis center, the hospital, the police. It's to, okay, I've got a problem and I've got a friend on the other line and I'm going to work it out with them and they're going to help me, and they might help me take a break from my kids and watch them for an hour so that I can just, you know, recoup and rejuvenate. So I think that's another essential component, is helping the parents develop an informal support network.
So while you're increasing maybe their skills and things along those lines, you're also building their self-reliance and I guess I'll say self-efficacy, or the feeling that they can control themselves in difficult situations,
yes,
as well as manage the family.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. That, and that's the, if I'm doing my job, Tom, that's that's a beautiful thing. It does work out that way. Yeah. Yeah. I don't want them going to the police. I want them, you know, initially. I think, and that's the other part of this, is I think a lot of times parents, we get these families and the parents are at their max, and you know, I know parents love their kids, but sometimes you don't like them. I'm a parent. Sometimes you don't like your kid. You love your kid, but sometimes, you know, during the temper tantrum, it's not your favorite moment. And you've hit these parents who have been dealing with this behavior for, you know, sometimes 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, and they're at their max. And so, kind of working with them to trust themselves, as opposed to needing somebody else, the police or even me in that matter.
And that there are times that the police are the right thing to do. But you're saying with
but knowing
this
when
exhaustion and frustration that not everything
is everything a police is. Call. Uh-huh. And, you know, in the beginning, I always tell my families, call me before you call the police and we'll determine, is it something that you can handle or something the police can handle? And the way I explain it is, you know, here we are working with you, mom and dad, caregiver, whomever, to put you in control. And when you're calling the police, you're telling the kid, I can't manage you. I have to call somebody else to manage you. So they're really undercutting and undermining their own authority when they do that. And a lot of times I'll even say to the parents when they call me, go someplace where the kid doesn't know you're calling me.
Okay.
You know, and I'll coach you over the phone and they don't have to know that I'm the other person on the phone. You know, we really just want to put the parent as the head of the household and empower them. And when they see these successes, it really kind of resonates. And that's when real good work gets done.
Okay. Is there any sort of maybe a case example or something you could share a little bit as we're finishing up?
Oh, yeah. Tom, I have a favorite case. And I know you're not, you know, they say you're not supposed to have favorites. I was a teacher earlier in my years and I did, but
it's confession.
It's
time.
A confession, true confessions. Yes, I had a family of 4 kids, and 3 were identified clients. They were acutely homicidal and suicidal, which I will say is typically not criteria that we will take in our home-based program. They can't be acutely homicidal and suicidal, but it turned out that we were at severe risk for losing. The mom was at severe risk for losing all 4 of her children. There had been the one caseworker on the case had called the Department of Job and Family Services on this mother 50 mm-hmm. times in a month. So
it's a lot of times.
And I think that, you know, what I'll tell you about this case, and obviously I'm going to tell you something successful, not successful, Tom. However, this was a successful case. I think that what worked in this case is that the mom had been in the system for so long, and we had to work where mom was. And there was some mental illness and there was some drug use going on with the mom. And if you look at the kid's behavior and why are the kids acting up, we had to address the drug use of mom, her inability to monitor when she was high.
Okay.
She couldn't really watch the kids, and her own mental illness. And we had to get that under control before we could really help her help the kids. And this was an absolutely brilliant mom who loved her children. And so we were, you know, way ahead of the game here, because we had a mom who was really willing to do anything to keep her children. And so in that sense, it was probably one of the easier cases. She hadn't gotten to the point where she was frustrated with her kids. It was just she didn't know how to keep them at this point. And so we were able to go in and help her figure out ways to keep them. So, you know, and it was a case of there was drug use by the kids. There was a teenage pregnancy. There was sexual abuse by a biological father. There was school truancy charges. I mean, you ran pretty much anything that would make a kid high risk went in on this family, you know, was part of this family. However, I think having that support to mom. And what really worked with this mom is saying, hey, you are the expert on your kids. And she started to believe it. And probably is the person that I learned the most from. In my 4 years there, I would say that she has made me a better therapist, and I've probably taken a few tricks from her. So I thank her for that, and I think I have thanked her in person. So, the big trick with her is really meeting the needs where they are, and it might not be focused on the kid. It might be, you never know, marital discord. It might be, like I said, parental drug use. You don't know, but you really need to target what's going on right now and what are they doing that maybe could be contributing to the child acting out behavior. And unless you get that under control, you know, you're not going to get very far.
Okay. Well, I think that will complete our discussion, unless you can think of anything that you would add that I haven't bothered to ask, which wouldn't be unusual.
No, I obviously feel pretty passionate about it. I've seen the successes, and having been on both sides, you know, there are times where I rack my brain and I'm thinking, why doesn't everybody see it like this? It's a pretty magical thing when it works. And I think that there are the resources out there to have home-based, intensive home-based everywhere. And it's definitely tainted me. I don't think I could go back to individual, Tom. So I think you've covered it, but thank you for letting me ramble. I enjoyed it.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you for the time again.
Absolutely.
You've just heard an interview of Mary Beth Towle, independently licensed clinical counselor, regarding home-based treatment for at-risk youth. Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselorAudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4015. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.